Okay, so I have two guests today. First up is Michael Wellman. Michael is a professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Michigan. His research focuses on computational market mechanisms and game theoretic reasoning methods with applications to electronic commerce, finance, and cybersecurity. I'd just like to welcome you to the show, Michael.
Thanks, nice to be here.
And my second guest is Uday Rajan. Uday is the Jack D. Sparks Whirlpool Corporation Research Professor of Business Administration and the Chair and Professor of Finance and Real Estate at the University of Michigan. His research focuses on informational frictions such as adverse selection and moral hazard and their effects on market transactions, with recent work on the role of credit ratings in the financial markets and on bank regulation. So, welcome to the show, Uday.
Thank you, John. I'm very pleased to be a part of your podcast.
So I invited you both onto the show today to discuss a paper that you recently co-authored entitled Ethical Issues for Autonomous Trading Agents. It was published in the journal Minds and Machines, and this is one of many papers that have been written recently on the ethical and regulatory challenges posed by automated trading systems. What I like about your paper in particular, and what differentiates it from most others, is the way in which you firmly ground it in financial theory and computer science. So what I'm hoping to do in our conversation today is to go through some of the main ideas and arguments in the paper, explaining some of the theoretical grounding and background for an audience of non-specialists. And I include myself in that group of non-specialists. So some of the details and technical aspects of the paper were a little bit beyond me. And I'm just reminded here, as we set up this conversation, of the scene in that film Margin Calls, where Jeremy Irons gets one of the traders to explain what he spotted in the market. So it's about the financial crash, and he says to him, "Imagine you're explaining it to a small child." So I'm filling the role of the small child, I think, in this conversation today. So I thought we'd divide the discussion up into two main chunks. One is just a set of introductory questions about the concept of autonomous trading, and then look at the centerpiece of your paper, which is this model architecture you sketch for an autonomous trading agent, and you use that then to explore some of the ethical and regulatory issues that might arise. So let me start with just a general question, which is, what is an autonomous trading agent?
A trading agent is a piece of software that makes trades. To say that it's autonomous is really just to emphasize that it's operating in some important sense on its own without direct human intervention. It's an algorithm, it's a computer program, it's reacting to information that it directly gets and making a decision without checking explicitly with a person.
Okay, so there's a lot of discussion about autonomous trading agents nowadays, and there seems to be a lot of hype about them. I mean, how prevalent are they in financial markets?
So from what I've read, if you look at high-frequency trading agents, which is only a subset of all software agents that are trading out there, the proportion of trades in the U.S. financial in the U.S. stock markets executed by high-frequency traders is estimated to have been around 50% in 2016. That's down a little bit from about 70% a few years earlier. But I do want to re-emphasize that high-frequency trades are only a subset of all software trading agents. And so most of the numbers I've seen have been in the range of 70 to 80% of trades.
Yeah, maybe you could just help by explaining that distinction between a high-frequency trading system and then the other kinds that are out there. I know there are lots,
Right.
but since high-frequency trading is the one that's often discussed most, how does that separate out from the other types?
So it's mostly by the speed at which they react. So in the trade press, I read a couple of months ago that there's a firm out there that allows high-frequency traders to react to market events and send in orders at a speed of about 20 to 30 nanoseconds, at a delay of about 20 to 30 nanoseconds. Now, a nanosecond is 1 billionth of a second. Just to put a, shall we say, a human benchmark on this, if you think of Usain Bolt, the fastest human on Earth, his reaction time at the start of 100 meters is around 0.15 seconds. So a high-frequency trader would, if I'm doing the math right, is somewhere approximately 10 million times as fast as Bolt. Now, we can have plenty of pieces of software that react a little bit slower than that. And so the distinction to my mind between high-frequency traders and other autonomous trading agents would just be the speed. I mean, a regular autonomous trading agent would still be reacting much faster than any human could. it just wouldn't be reacting quite as fast as a high frequency trader.
What I would add to that is that all computers are very fast. So even a program that isn't categorized as high frequency trading might be very fast by human reaction time standards. We usually apply the term high frequency trading when it's a special advantage of the algorithm that it is trying to take advantage of its edge on speed. That is, certain strategies are really keyed on the fact that they're faster than other reactors in the market.
Yeah, so high-frequency trading, they're competing on speed rather than other kinds of variables or factors. The other thing, I mean, so you're talking about autonomous trading agents here, but if we talk about the role of AI more generally in financial systems, presumably that's much larger. I mean, I can't imagine there are many main players in financial markets who aren't using some kind of AI-based assistance to guide their trading strategies.
That's right. I think AI, artificial intelligence, can be applied at various parts of the pipeline. So even if the trades are ultimately executed through human commands, there may be analysis and generation of ideas and summaries of data that come from machine learning or other AI techniques. Similarly, even outside of trading per se, the financial system, there's a lot of automated decision making about lending and, you know, all kinds of other financial activities that is influenced by AI these days.
Yeah. So when you're setting out that 50% figure or the 70% figure earlier on, we're using that to refer specifically to the trades that are executed autonomously by autonomous agents as opposed to through some sort of decision support system.
Yes.
Okay. So just, we'll probably get into this in a little bit more detail later on, but at a general level, what are the positives to the use of autonomous trading agents? Like, why do people use them, and are there social benefits to it as well?
Well, there's quite a bit of an efficiency advantage just to the way that markets have become electronic and have provided interfaces to computers. You know, poring over reams of financial data and issuing trades is a pretty tedious thing. And computers can do it a lot better than people, even on a routine basis. To some extent, being able to, you know, react faster, that if you, you know, seconds rather than minutes or hours, is something that can make markets more responsive to information, more consistent and efficient. And that's generally a good thing.
So just to add to that, from the side of a financial economist, it is extremely important that financial markets, in some sense, get the prices of assets right. Now, to some extent, I'll put that right within quotes, because, you know, it is people trading in the financial markets that eventually conclude what the right price is. But prices are really important in the economy because they communicate information about firms and information about the prospects of firms to all investors in the economy. They also communicate the same information to CEOs and firm management. So there's a research by Edmonds, Goldstein, and Jiang showing that firm managers react to their own stock prices. When stock prices are high, firms invest a lot. When they're low, firms invest less. So it's important for us as an economy to get the price right, so we communicate the right signals to all people. And then just to follow up, just in my layman's sense, to the extent that the machines are smarter than humans at some things now, we should be using machines to try and get the prices right.
Yeah, you know, from the AI perspective, you know, we talk a lot about the way that AI technology may be changing traditional human jobs. Well, the stereotypical view of a financial market as a trading pit with a lot of big guys yelling at each other, that's obsolete. That doesn't happen anymore. And not too many people really miss it or think that would be a better system.
Yeah, I think I heard somebody recently describe the trading floor in the New York Stock Exchange as effectively just a backdrop for cable news media. It's not really an active site of trading activity anymore.
Just for TV.
Yeah, just for TV. There was something that you mentioned there. Oh, so the kind of argument that Uday was sketching, that to me that seems Hayekian in nature. So it's the prices as important signals communicating information to people, and there's some benefit to the use of these trading agents in signaling the right kind of price.
That's right. Hayek was among the first people to point out the role of prices in the economy. And in fact, in Hayek's own work, he had talked about the role of prices in communicating information on demand and supply about physical goods. Well, the exact same argument extends to prices of financial assets as well.
But I'd say that, you know, while Hayek is often associated with a pretty extreme ideology, or sometimes invoked that way, this notion of prices signaling information is very mainstream and widely accepted.
Yeah, sure. The other thing then, just before we move on to maybe some of the specific details in your paper, there have been some scandals associated with the use of autonomous trading agents. Maybe you could just talk briefly about a couple of them.
Well, one pretty dramatic episode was about 5 years ago when a company called Knight Capital put out a new version of their software that wasn't configured right, and it wound up making millions of dollars of random trades, and it cost the company about $400 million, and it went bankrupt soon after. So here's an example where it wasn't really the AI working at it as it was supposed to, but more run-of-the-mill software errors that led to a dramatic effect. In this case, it didn't really hurt the markets, didn't hurt anybody else, just hurt the company that was doing it.
Yeah, and what about the flash crash of 2010? I mean, do we know anything? I mean, initially the stories were that this was linked to the use of AI-based trading platforms, but is that still the story?
Right. From the reports that have been put out that have looked into the flash crash, it seems that it began in the S&P futures market, in the S&P mini futures market, where there was one trader submitting a large volume of orders to the S&P futures market, and that was leading to a big change in prices in that market. And that then in turn had an impact on stocks. Prices of stocks suddenly became more volatile. Many of the high-frequency traders that usually make our markets liquid spotted that the prices were becoming more volatile. And again, in my human sort of layperson way of putting things, the high-frequency traders were a little bit confused of what to do, so they sat on the sidelines for a little while, and as a result of that, prices went completely haywire on some stocks. You had some stocks that were being sold for a penny, others where the price had gone up to sort of thousands of dollars, and at the end, we had to put a sort of halt to the market for a short period of time before everybody could sort of figure out what was going on. I have to say, the flash crash was an extremely dramatic event. We are fortunate that it was also a very short-lived event, that putting a halt to the market did allow everybody time to catch their breath. And when we came back online, the markets pretty much came back to where they had been.
And it would be very good to understand to what extent the automated traders had a role in the recovery as well as the initial effect. I think, as Uday is saying, it's the automated trading was exonerated as the proximal cause, but may really have set the conditions to make this kind of thing more likely to happen. And to be very honest, we don't really understand what exactly could trigger such an event to happen again today or tomorrow.
Yeah, just for listeners, there was an earlier podcast I did with a guy called Anders Sandberg from Oxford University about speed mismatches between humans and computers, which looked a little bit at this phenomenon. So his argument was that it's this speed mismatch that created the problems arising from the flash crash. So these systems can lead to these high magnitude events in a very short period of time, and it's difficult for humans to figure out exactly what happened and respond on equivalent timescales. So having something like a kill switch or something to halt the trading seems to be the way to solve this so that humans can catch up to what's happening. Okay, so that's just to set the stage as what autonomous trading agents are and some of their benefits and some of the scandals that they've been associated with as well. The centerpiece of your article, however, is the model architecture that you sketch for understanding how autonomous trading agents might work and what their advantages and disadvantages are. So I'm hoping if we can try and explain this model for the general audience that are listening. This requires some unpacking. So the basic idea that I get from your paper is that you sketch an architecture for an autonomous trading agent that takes advantage of arbitrage opportunities, but that could in turn be developed or co-opted towards more nefarious or ethically dubious uses. And I mean, the goal here is to understand how that development might take place and what the appropriate responses are. But there are important concepts that help to clarify what this idea is. So let's just start with a very simple concept from financial theory, which is the concept of arbitrage and an arbitrage operation. Because, again, the goal is to design an autonomous agent that will take advantage of arbitrage opportunities. So, yeah, could you just maybe explain what that means?
Yes. Go ahead, Michael.
I was going to say, very simply stated, arbitrage is taking advantage of disparities in prices between different markets. The simplest kind is when you have the same good, or say a financial security, that may be traded in two different markets or two different locations. And if you notice a disparity in the prices at those two markets, you could buy in one and sell in the other and make a sure profit.
Yeah, so just as an example, if you look at Apple stock, it's the price I'm seeing on my screen before, this is before the US markets have opened, is $144.53. Now, Apple happens to be traded on several exchanges in the US. It's traded on NASDAQ, it's traded on the NYSE. If a trader were to spot Apple at $140 per share in one market and $145 per share in the other market, they could buy it low, sell it high, and make a profit without taking any risk. And that really is part of the key to what an arbitrage is. It's really a financial trader's dream. You make money without taking any risk at all.
Yeah, so a central part or goal of many financial traders is to just spot arbitrage opportunities and then take advantage of them.
Yes.
That's right. And what we develop in the paper, the thesis here, is that actually many, if not most, strategies that are employed in algorithmic trading can be viewed as some kind of arbitrage. The simple kind, when it's exactly the same security on one market and another, is obviously very easy to define as a strategy and to look for. What is a little bit more complex is when the securities are not exactly identical. There is some mapping or translation that one has to do, say between an option and an underlying security, or a security and an index or a future, that is related by some derivative relation or some formal definition, and by the computer understanding how they relate to each other, they can realize that that is also a disparity in effective prices that they can take advantage of.
So, I mean, the example you use in the paper has to do with an arbitrage on index securities. So could you perhaps sketch what that is? It's a position-neutral transaction that you're... Right. Exercising. So maybe explain some of those concepts and ideas to listeners.
So I'm going to have a go at this from a slightly different angle. I warn both of you, this may or may not work. So if it sounds like I'm crazy, so be it. Supposing instead of financial claims, I was buying components for a car and trying to sell cars. So I'm a trader. I'm looking around to find components for a BMW car. And I find I can purchase the components for a BMW car and assemble the car and sell it at a price lower than BMW is doing it. Well, with a car, that's extremely hard to do. Well, firstly, there are thousands of components, so I'd have to do a really extensive search. But also, there's a huge amount of skill, and there's a huge amount of technology that goes into trying to put the car together as a vehicle that runs. Now, when we start thinking about financial portfolios, one aspect of that metaphor goes through, which is, in principle, there could be thousands of financial assets that I need to trade to create this arbitrage. But the second piece, that even after I have all the components, there's a lot of skill in trying to put things together in a specific way where that no longer holds. A financial portfolio is, I just own thousands of assets. There's nothing else I need to do beyond that point. So in particular, when we get to something like index securities, and in our paper, we talk about financial assets that are based in the Standard & Poor's 500 index. Well, the Standard & Poor's 500 index consists of the stocks of 500 firms. So to create an arbitrage on, say, futures in the S&P 500 or what we call the SPIDR, the SPDR that we refer to in our paper, I need to know what the S&P 500 index is at any point of time. I need to know the prices of each of the underlying 500 stocks. The S&P 500 index consists of 500 stocks with given weights on them. You give me 500 price numbers, you give me the weights, a computer can do the math right away to figure out if the weighted average comes out to be what the S&P 500 is. If it's not, then we have an arbitrage whereby we either sell the bundled good, the S&P 500 depository receipt, and we buy the 500 stocks, or we do the reverse. We sell each of the 500 stocks and we buy the spider.
Yeah, I think that's a really helpful analogy. The index security is a very simple way that components are combined into a larger entity that is equivalent, and therefore you could find and evaluate a price disparity. But more generally, all kinds of financial assets are really, they're just formal legal claims on some cash flows or on some financial returns. And if you understand what the rules are underlying those legal claims, you could reason about under what circumstances one set of financial assets is technically equivalent to another, even though if on the surface they have different labels and they are called different things and traded in different places, if they legally amount to the same claims, then there's an identity between them and you can perform arbitrage on that identity.
Yeah, okay, so this is that is helpful to me actually to understand it. So if we go back to, let's say, to the simple example that Uday gave at the very start of this conversation about the price differential between two Apple shares trading on different markets. There's an identity relation there between those two shares, but they're priced differently across two different markets.
That's right. That's the simplest identity relationship. They really are the same thing.
Yeah, so they're exactly the same thing in two different markets. And it's very simple for a human being in a way to spot that price differential and take advantage of that opportunity. What you're outlining here in relation to the index securities is more complex and more abstract. So the concept of the index security, as you say, is a claim on some cash flow somewhere. And all financially traded items are effectively claims on cash flows. They might be labeled in different ways, and there might be bundles of them bundled together, but they might amount factually to the same thing. So then spotting the price differential between the kind of, say, the prices attached to the bundles enables you to take advantage of an arbitrage opportunity, because one bundle is priced in a different way in one market versus another. But it's complicated to spot that, but in principle, there's a formal definition or formal identity relation that can be discovered, and you can design autonomous trading agents to actually spot or figure out those identity relations.
That's right. And once you figure it out, you could evaluate it. But of course, if it is complex, then a person could never monitor all the markets fast enough to detect it in time to act on it. And then you need computers to do it, because if at a human timescale, the price disparity would never last long enough in order to take advantage of it. In arbitrage, that's called execution risk. That is, you notice the arbitrage, but by the time you act on it, some things may have changed. That's one of the drivers to high-frequency trading and trying to make the response as fast as possible to minimize that execution risk.
Yeah, sorry. And then another type of risk associated with it that you mentioned are the transaction costs associated with performing the trade.
That's right. So you need the that price differential to be large enough to cover any cost of actually going ahead and taking advantage of it.
Yes, sir. I shouldn't have called that a risk necessarily. So it's the actual cost of performing the trade has to be less than the value of the arbitrage itself.
Yes.
Just briefly, then one other concept which I didn't fully grasp, and maybe you've covered this already to some extent, but the idea of a position neutral transaction. The position neutral transaction, it's position neutral because you end up with the same bundle of assets effectively. Is that why it's neutral?
Yes, exactly. To be neutral, as you said, John, it has to be the case that you've bought a bundle of assets in one market or some set of markets, and you've sold the exact same bundle of assets in some other market. If you have not done that, then you have taken on a position that has exposed you to risk.
Yeah, and exactly the same here means with respect to the underlying financial claim, so that they're equivalent in the fundamental sense.
Yes, so the actual traded items might be different, the names attached to them, the labels attached to them, but the underlying claims on cash flows are identical.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay, and I mean, we've got into this a little bit already, and maybe we're repeating ourselves if I ask it again, but I'm just going to ask it to see if there's anything additional to be added. The advantage of constructing an autonomous agent to conduct this kind of arbitrage operation is to minimize execution risk associated with speed, and also to perform complex identity checking that humans could never perform. Are there any other advantages to using autonomous agents to perform these trades?
I think those are the main things. Being able to monitor all the markets and act on them very quickly.
And there's also this intrinsic sense that traders compete with each other to find these arbitrages. So to the extent we're competing, I would like to be quicker than you. You conversely would like to be quicker than me. Sooner or later, one of us is going to start using the quickest tools out there, which is computers and software, and we're going to have this race to be trying quicker than each other.
That's right, because of course, once one trader discovers it and acts on it, that will make the opportunity go away.
Yeah, I mean, so the idea is that traders here are acting on some kind of informational advantage that they have over their competing traders. They could all spot the same thing at the same time, and then basically eliminate the value of conducting the trade. So the idea is that they have to get in there faster than the other traders. And this is where autonomous trading platforms become beneficial.
And you know, the part of our architecture that may be a little bit more speculative or forward-looking is the notion that the AIs will actually provide an advantage to discovering these arbitrage opportunities. Because as all the simple ones are covered and understood, there's always another kind of race to find yet more and more complex and subtle and maybe even slightly inexact identities that nevertheless are useful. So they're always sort of pushing the envelope on what's considered an exact identity and an arbitrage. And that can be done through more complex search over the space of financial securities, or machine learning techniques that discover statistical regularities that may not hold by definition, but still hold reliably enough in actuality to take advantage as arbitrage.
Yeah, so you're imagining here a level of dynamism and adaptiveness and learning to these systems that, yeah, they can go beyond the initial remits set by their human programmers, that they can actually spot and identify new arbitrage opportunities, such as these statistical arbitrage opportunities, which are not just simple yes or no identity relations. They hold probabilistically as opposed to more generally.
That's right.
Okay, so that really brings us to the question about the downsides of the construction of the autonomous trading agent. So you move through a series of stages. So, I mean, the big focus in the paper initially anyway is on how autonomous trading agents could actually start to engage in devious behavior to try and manipulate the market in some way. And I see kind of three stages to the discussion. One is where you talk about these agents engaging in spoofing, then market manipulation, and then artificial arbitrage. So let's maybe just proceed through those three stages, starting with spoofing. What is the concept of spoofing? What's the idea behind a spoofing trade?
Well, spoofing is a form of market manipulation. And the basic idea there is that a trader puts out spurious orders that they really did not intend to transact, in order to mislead others about what the current market situation is, to get the prices to move in a certain direction that they can take advantage of. You know, just stepping back a moment, remember we're imagining that we observe that the algorithms have a special advantage in arbitrage. Well, once you have capability, you have a very strong incentive to make prices move more so that these opportunities come up more often. And market manipulation and spoofing in particular is one way to do this, by getting prices to be out of whack from what the true market conditions are.
So just to follow up with an example, suppose I want to sell a financial asset. Well, I'd like to get a high price for it. I look at the price at which it's trading in the market right now, and it's not as high as I would like. So what some traders can do in these markets is they can put in spoofing orders on the buy side, on the side other than the one that they want to actually trade on. And then they know that the rest of the market is going to be looking at the volume of orders on either side. If we see a sudden flood of buy orders in the market, other traders might think, well, some sort of event has happened that should make us change our beliefs about the cash flows on this asset. And they might start to bid the price up. And then there's a chance that the price might get high enough to the point where I get the price that I'm looking for when I sell the asset.
Yeah, so spoofing is a way of either driving up or driving down the price of a particular asset by putting in a lot of orders on the buyer or sell side.
Right.
And then an autonomous trading agent could presumably engage in this on much faster timescales than human beings could. And maybe this is something around the kind of flash crash. I believe originally the idea was that was maybe one of the initial explanations of these sudden events in markets. A lot of spoofing algorithms.
So spoofing is actually pretty common in actual markets performed by a variety of actors. It's illegal. And there was observed to be spoofing around the flash crash, and there was a very high-profile arrest in London of somebody. I think that the claims that they were causal or really important in the flash crash are somewhat controversial, or there's reasons to be skeptical of that. But nevertheless, it's certainly something that's not good for markets.
And just to go back to a point you had made, John, with trading agents, the whole idea is these events happen at a much quicker speed than before. Like spoofing, trying to sort of affect market prices by engaging in illegal behavior, that could have gone on even without the use of software. It's just that when we're using trading agents, these things go happen much, much more quickly than before.
And I think what we're really concerned about also is that through machine learning and other advanced techniques, new spoofing techniques can be developed that maybe either are more effective or faster or harder to detect or easier to mask, or are harder to trace down because they have a lot of other obfuscation about what's going on. So the general arms race that there always is between market manipulators and enforcement and regulation is accelerated.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of hinted at that anyway when you said that spoofing is quite common, but it's illegal. So even though it's illegal, people still engage in it, and it can be difficult to actually spot at the moment. Is that correct diagnosis of the current situation?
That's absolutely right. My understanding is that there's continual surveillance, partially automated in all financial exchanges, and they often do catch and stop spoofing. Actual prosecutions are pretty rare, but those happen, and it winds up to be sometimes quite difficult to establish beyond a reasonable doubt or whatever the standard is that a spoofing actually happened. Part of that is that remember when I defined it, I pointed out that someone was placing an order that they did not intend to actually trade. Well, getting at this underlying intent behind the order is, as you might imagine, a very subtle and tricky thing to do. It may be even harder to infer intent when the order is put out by an algorithm that is following some strategy, maybe a strategy that was derived automatically by machine learning.
Yeah, so what we have here really is just a problem to some extent anyway, of a mismatch between legalistic concepts like market manipulation or spoofing that are defined in terms of human intentionality and how they apply to autonomous trading agents. In other contexts, like outside of trading, the use of AI and autonomous weapon systems, self-driving cars, people have written a lot on those topics about responsibility gaps opening up with the use of those devices. Events occur that are bad, but there's no responsible agent behind them. So what you're suggesting here in relation to market manipulation and spoofing is that the exact same thing arises in the case of an autonomous trading agent.
Yes, and I think it's worse when the actual law, when of course laws change very slowly, are defined in terms of that underlying intent. And that covers things like market manipulation, but even more broadly, all kinds of fraud laws and fake news and other kind of situations where it's going to be harder and harder to really pin down the responsibility for the ultimate actor that's creating the fraud.
Yeah, just one thing there. I mean, you mentioned that it's hard enough as it is in, let's say, complex financial trades to figure out what the intent behind them was, and also in corporate organizations to figure out the lines of responsibility within those systems. And now we're adding an additional layer of complexity to that in terms of working out what the ultimate intent behind those systems is, or those trades are.
Indeed.
I've maybe set this off on a incorrect course, and because I mentioned spoofing as something distinct from market manipulation, but you corrected me to say it's a form of market manipulation, and your analysis is about the different forms of market manipulation that an autonomous trading agent could engage in. So what are the other types of market manipulation that are potentially on the cards with the use of these autonomous trading agents?
Well, another is to use other channels besides markets, for example, social media, to try to spread false information that could affect the prices of financial assets. And that is something that also happens manually to some extent. But again, the ability to automatically participate in social media and tweet things and so on, it just opens up more attack possibilities. I find it useful to frame these problems in the same way that we think of as cybersecurity. These are attacks, particularly on market integrity.
So I just want to add a couple of things to that. One is a disclaimer. I know both Michael and I are in the U.S. I do want to state, for the purpose of your listeners, we are not paying any more attention to Twitter and to tweets than we were before a certain presidential election in the U.S. last year. But the second thing I want to add about offline events that can happen that are of the form that Michael mentioned, a recent event that happened in Europe a couple of weeks ago. You may have read about this, John. The Champions League quarterfinal, Borussia Dortmund was supposed to play a game.
Really
horrible event where somebody sort of bombed the team bus and some of the players were injured and perhaps other people were injured. And what I've read is that the person who did this was a person who wanted to drive down the stock price of Borussia Dortmund. It's actually a public firm. They wanted to drive down the stock price because they had a short position in the stock. Now, if you think of a smart agent, a software agent, thank goodness, cannot go off and bomb things on its own. But as Michael mentioned, it's not that hard for a smart software agent to create a fake Twitter account and send out fake tweets. And, you know, this can damage the prices of financial assets as much as this other event.
Yeah, I just want to say, I interrupted you a little bit there to say that this was a good story. I don't mean it's a good story in the sense of what the events were, but it's a good example of what you're talking about here. So this was a Russian trader, I think, who was trying to drive down the stock price through these bombings on the Borussia Dortmund bus. And I think there are some examples, and maybe you're aware of them more than I am, of tweets having an effect on stock market prices. So I think, again, Andrew Sandberg, in the interview I did with him, brought up an example of some tweet celebrating the Yom Kippur War, the 40th anniversary of it or something, had an effect on the price of oil or some other commodity on the market. Because these systems are swallowing up information from so many different sources and reacting very quickly, they don't easily, or there is no maybe good mechanism at the moment for them to distinguish between true and false information online.
That's right. It's not just the algorithms that are maybe doing the false tweeting. There's algorithms that are reading the tweets to in order to create market intelligence, and they can feed into each other.
Yeah, and this also then kind of brings us back to the original argument about prices signaling information. I mean, the idea here is that markets are in a sense information processing machines. They swallow up information and they spit it out in the form of prices, and they're swallowing up information from lots of different sources. So if anybody can tamper with or alter the informational sources that are being fed into markets, it can have an effect on prices and could manipulate market prices. And this is something that trading agents could do.
That's right. And then, you know, an AI actually may also help in developing more robust algorithms that are resistant to false information or misinformation and can make those distinctions. But again, that's one of these continual arms races where the ones that are trying to detect the bad actions are evolving in the same time frame that the attacks themselves are evolving.
So we've outlined some of the problems here, and I have two questions I want to close on. The first one is, how do we address these threats and challenges? So you mentioned one example is to use AI itself as a response and a tool, an arms race. But as you mentioned, there'll be this arms race between the manipulative algorithms and the protective algorithms. Are there any other solutions to the potential threats that might be posed?
Well, I think an avenue to solution is also to consider the design of the markets themselves. We think of these things, and we laid out this out in the paper in several levels. And there may be some kinds of solutions that just work by changing the interface or the API of the market to the trading agents that disallow certain categories of potentially dangerous actions. And so we would look to design of markets to make them more resistant as something that can be done. You can maybe build some of this detection and protection of certain kinds of manipulations also into the basic infrastructure. And sometimes, you know, a way to prevent misinformation is also just to better authenticate the channels, to maybe even sometimes limit what information gets disseminated to prevent bad information from getting disseminated.
So just a quick follow-up to two points. So one is Michael's point about perhaps we can think about the rules of the market itself and changing those in some way to prevent certain kinds of behavior. And this relates to some of Michael's own work. Right now, high-frequency traders can trade, as I said, possibly at the speed of 20 or 30 nanoseconds per trade. What if, rather than allowing those speeds, we slowed the markets down to a point where we have markets clear by what is called frequent batch auctions, say markets clear every half second or so? As a human, we wouldn't notice the, you know, markets clearing every half second are still extremely liquid and we wouldn't really feel it. And yet it would slow down some parts of the high frequency arms race. And the second point, going back to your question itself, John, this, it's almost to some extent, I think of it as a little bit like the problem of drug testing in sports. That is, on the one hand, the regulators are always going to be trying to play catch up with the cheats. As long as there are incentives to cheat, and as long as I can make money by cheating, there is going to be an incentive for people to cheat. People are going to try and find, you know, you can design the rules any which way you want, and people are going to try and find some loopholes or some ways around them, or some ways they can make more money. And so, to some extent, the regulators will have to keep pace with that.
Yeah, and what I'm, you know, particularly concerned about is that the new ways to cheat, the search for new ways to cheat, is what itself can be automated, and that may provide a kind of plausible deniability. If a programmer just says, "I designed my algorithm to search for ways to make money by trading," it may stumble on what is actually a manipulative or a cheating technique, even if that was not what the programmer explicitly commanded. We have to make sure that we somehow rule out those parts of the search when we automatically look for strategies.
So it seems like you're advocating really a design-based approach to the regulation and management of this. So it's better market design. It's not new regulations or more regulations. It's better market design.
I would say we may have to change how existing regulations are applied to also cover – they're designed for human activity, and because of that, they may not be a great match to the algorithmic activity. I think the concepts of the existing regulations in manipulation are probably already okay.
Okay. And the other point then, the last question I have, and this ties into something you actually really just mentioned, which is, so imagine this trader who's creating an algorithm to search for arbitrage opportunities or to make as much money as possible. That's, in some sense, translates into the general instructions that he programs into the algorithm, but then it develops this technique that is a form of market manipulation. What we have here is a classic illustration of a control problem, or like a principal agent type problem, where the trader or programmer is the principal and the machine is the agent. And this is a problem that is discussed a lot in the literature on artificial intelligence and the risks posed by artificial intelligence. So if we go to a more extreme set of risks outlined by the likes of Elon Musk and Nick Bostrom, the idea is that, so, you know, super intelligent AI could eventually destroy us all because it will hit upon solutions to goals that it has been set that are actually destructive or counterproductive to human flourishing. And this is something you do mention at the outset of your paper, and your suggestion is that the discussion of trading AIs and how to regulate and manage them and control them can shed some light on this more extreme set of risks, this broader debate about AI control. What lessons do you think can be learned?
So the way I think about it is that we're going to be facing these shorter term tasks of controlling AI or autonomous agents in real practice. We hope with some significant advance over the the true superintelligence, and that will give us experience in an idea, new control ideas that don't really exist today. And I think I'm all for also thinking about the long-term challenges of superintelligence, but those are somewhat abstract and maybe difficult to tell whether the control ideas are working or not. By also looking at the nearer term, and you know, automated trading is an issue today, we will get valuable lessons about how to simultaneously work on technological controls, regulatory controls, new legal concepts that will provide experience that will prepare us for the longer term as well.
Any comments on that, Uday?
No, I don't have anything to add to that. I mean, my knowledge of AI and how smart machines can get is significantly more anecdotal than either Michael's or yours. I mean, the vision I have of smart machines still goes back to the computer HAL in 2001, The Space Odyssey, where indeed the machines take over the world. And my mind, at the back of my mind, that's the fear with AI.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I could just end on that question. I mean, the future here with AI, is it bright or is it dark? I mean, I know that's a very binary way of looking at it, and you can challenge it if you like, but what's your outlook? Is it optimistic or pessimistic? Both of you.
Well, I guess the way I'd put it, it doesn't matter if what we predict, but I think we should prepare for the pessimistic outcomes that we can anticipate.
That's well put. I mean, I will say I am quite a bit of an optimist in terms of all of the good that computers and AI have done for us so far, that, you know, we have managed to harness these machines in ways to benefit humans. I completely agree with Michael that when we think about risks and trying to take care of risks, immediately you don your pessimist hat and say, well, what are some of the worst case scenarios and how can I try to rule out the worst case scenarios? But at least to the broader question of whether I'm an optimist or a pessimist, chalk me squarely down in the optimist column.
So plan for the worst and hope for the best, I think, is the
there
bottom line here.
There you go.
Okay, thank you very much for joining me for this conversation.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.